On This Week in Enterprise Tech, China has a Great Wall of XP fail, Google's going wireless, a patent troll gets slapped, and the FCC kinda, sorta, whatever, supports net neutrality. Twine on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 89, recorded April 28th, 2014. A nesting doll of patent trolley goodness. Welcome to TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But as always, I'm not guiding you by myself. I'm joined by my co-host, my good friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, so good to have you back. How you doing?
I am electrified. Thank you very much, Sears, for swapping out a dead battery.
Yeah, it's actually, you texted me this morning saying that your battery was dead. And I guess there was a long line at Sears because of the long weekend. I have no idea what that means.
Just people all lined up. Everybody saves all the repairs for Monday morning.
Got it. Oh, well. Well, you know, a person who doesn't need repairs on Monday morning, he's always good to go. Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it's great to see you. How are things over on the right coast?
It's a beautiful, warm day here in sunny Florida. The swamp is bubbling right along, and it's great to be here on TWiET.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to get right into the Enterprise Bites, but before we do that, it's been a busy week. There's been a lot of news, so I thought we might want to cover a bunch of them in blips. This first blip is all about AT&T. Now, you may remember last week, they decided they were going to take their ball and go home. They were specifically addressing the FCC's spectrum option, and they said, well, if the caps are currently as they are written, it would not allow them enough RF spectrum to properly deploy LTE devices. So they said, we're not going to bid. We're not going to be part of your multi-billion dollar auction. The FCC called their bluff with a representative saying that AT&T, quote, needed to do what they needed to do to make business sense, and that the auction would go on as scheduled with a part of the willing. Now, this week, AT&T backed off, issuing a statement that said, quote, unquote, our desire to participate in this auction and our hope for a successful auction is unchanged. We believe that all stakeholders will be able to work together to achieve a successful, inventive auction for the 600 megahertz band. So, in other words, kudos to the FCC. See what happens when you stand up to a telco bully? Our second blip is all about a new zero-day bug found in Internet Explorer. Now, this is not new, but this one is pretty bad. We know bugs come out all the time. This one actually has the Department of Homeland Security issuing a security alert to stop using IE. The bug affects anyone using Microsoft's Internet Explorer version 6 and above, and it allows an attacker to run malicious code remotely. Usage of IE hovers between 23 and 55%, meaning hacks. Hacks for everyone. Our last blip comes to us from the Washington Post, talking about Microsoft finalizing the deal for Nokia's phone division. Now, it cost Microsoft £3.21 billion to buy Nokia's devices and services, and another £1.3 billion for Nokia's patents. The final deal sheds a Korean facility and 200 jobs, and Nokia CEO Stephen Elop will be moving to Redmond to envy Satya Nadella's seat. Now, let's get right into the Enterprise Bites. Chibert, you know all about Microsoft XP, right?
Yeah. XP's been around a long time and, you know, very well-formulated holes.
Holes. And we've talked a lot about the Xpocalypse, this idea that because it's reached end of life and Redmond will no longer be updating patches for the venerable operating system, it's a nightmare for especially government agencies who have had to shell out money to Microsoft for a few thousand systems that just need to keep running until they finish their deployment of new systems. Well, a couple of thousand, maybe even 100,000 PCs sounds bad, but what if you had several hundred million. That's exactly what China is facing right now. There was a report in Network World that the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology in China reported that upwards of 70% of the PCs across all of China are still running Windows XP. Now, the ministry is looking to support efforts for a homegrown version of Linux. You can read customized for whatever they need it for on their networks to offer as a replacement for those Windows PCs. Now, of course, China does have one of the highest piracy rates around the world. It's estimated that about 77% of all the software that runs in China has not been properly licensed. And breaking that down even further, it's estimated that upwards of 90% of those copies of Windows XP are illegal. Let me throw this over to you first, Curtis. This is one of those things that people were speculating about, that, yeah, it's going to be tough for China because it was much easier to pirate XP than it is to pirate 7 or 8. Does this tell you that, yeah, they're just not committed to becoming a legal licensing country?
Well, I just honestly say, try that again with words. I don't think that they have a lot of incentive to become a legal, fully licensed environment. Windows XP has been doing what they needed it to do. It will continue to do what they need it to do because China, let's face it, has some decent hackers. The same hackers that attack other people's systems can help come out with unauthorized patches for the copies of XP that really need them. For the rest of the users, I think they're going to either skip ahead to unauthorized copies or something else, or simply be one of the populations that leads the march away from the PC. Tons and tons and tons of mobile devices in use in China. I think that is probably a trend we're going to see accelerate out of this rather than any sort of trend that would increase the revenue stream in Redmond.
Actually, I really, really like that, Curtis. Curtis, that's a great point. Chivert, let me throw that back over to you. We know that 8 months ago, the last time we did a comprehensive check of all browser traffic in the United States, we knew that 1 in 6 PCs in the United States ran Windows XP. That compares to 72.1% 8 months ago in China. Now, one of the problems is that people just aren't buying new PCs in China. They're staying with their Windows XP machine because their next computer is going to be a tablet, or it's going to be their phone. It's basically any mobile device that's going to do the stuff that they would typically have done on the PC. Do email, browse, bring up information, et cetera, et cetera. So my question to you is this. Is the key not to introduce a new operating system in China, but just to let nature take its course and let those XP PCs die?
You know, I don't know. You know, the temptation is too much. The snarky response is kind of what I want to use. And the snarky response is, no, I love this because that makes it easier for the U.S. Intelligence community to go and turn off the lights in China or spy on the Chinese MSS. Remember, the MSS is the equivalent of the CIA in China. So more power to them. They can steal all they want. They can steal all the vulnerabilities they want. That's all fine and good. Now, the realistic view of the world is a non-snarky response is most of the PCs are going to be that stay that way because they have the Chinese character sets. People are able to use it. There's some very, very good Chinese word processors out there that will actually do what you want. You can actually type in simpler characters phonetically and then scroll through the more complex ideograms. The trick with the tablets is they're going to start using a lot more of the back end so they can actually draw the characters on the screen and build their documents. So tablets and touch systems in general make a lot more sense in Asian countries anyway.
Chibert, I get that. I understand that. I have that natural sense to do snark as well, but there is a larger issue here, and I want to give that over to you, Curtis. It's easy to say, well, who cares because they're pirated copies of Windows XP anyway. But the issue that a lot of people are having is if you get 600 million infected machines, that's an awfully horrible botnet to unleash on the world. And we know that XP you shouldn't be using it anymore. I mean, it doesn't matter whether or not you're experiencing the latest IE zero-day bug. XP is just the system that if you're not migrated from, you should be migrating away from right now. What's it to say about a country where they've got this mystical solution of a Linux version that will be approved by some Politburo in China, which will never happen because things move so slowly. In fact, some of the people in the chat room are remembering that there was a red version of Linux that was supposed to come out 3 years ago, never really materialized. Do we have to worry about having all these machines open, completely vulnerable, and most likely owned?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that despite what we're seeing, because they were unauthorized and many of them were behind all sorts of interesting filters and firewalls, I'm not sure that they are any more ownable today than they were a year ago. I'm not positive that that aspect has changed or will change very quickly. Remember, a lot of these systems that we're talking about don't have access to the same sort of high bandwidth broadband that we have in the West, or even that they have in other parts of Asia. The real bandwidth opportunities in Asia are largely coming about through the wireless networks. And so I think those are going to be the ones that help usher the country into mobile devices and away from the standard desktop kind of platforms. You know, this is an interesting thing. You mentioned the botnets. To me, the real issue isn't whether we should fear them because of the botnets that could be unleashed using those machines as tools. The real question is whether that many tiny laboratories on which hackers can experiment should accelerate the shift in other countries away from XP. And I think the answer to that is a definite yes.
Well, gentlemen, that's 10 minutes on the X-pocalypse, and I promise we would never have more than 10 minutes for any show. So let's move on to the next Enterprise Byte. This time, we're talking about something closer to home and something that I think a lot of people watching the show love, and that is Google Fiber. We all want it. We all want it now. And there's a little bit of news coming out of IDG. They got an exclusive peek at a document that talks about Google's drive to add Wi-Fi to all their Google Fiber cities. Now, according to IDG News Service, Google is mulling the idea of deploying Wi-Fi networks in cities and towns that are already wired for Google Fiber. Now, the document didn't spell out any specific details of the plan, but it did release some juicy tidbits about the potential deployment plans for the 34 cities that were announced as candidates for the Google Fiber expansion program. Now, you may remember Google Fiber started in 2012 with Kansas City. 2013 saw the network expand to Olathe, North Kansas, Austin, and Provo. And in 2014, they named 34 cities and towns, including Phoenix, Scottsdale, San Jose, Palo Alto, Atlanta, Decatur, East Point, Chapel Hill. The list goes on and on and on. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to run it to those cities. What they would like is they would like some sort of collaboration with local governance to say, look, we have something that your citizens would like. We really want to give it to them, and we want to give it at a price that would both disrupt the industry in your area, drive innovation, increase property values, and make people happy. All we ask of you is that you play ball. Please cut the red tape, make it easy for us to come in, give us the right of way, give us an easy deployment avenue, and we'll take care of the rest. What we knew about that before. What this document adds is it adds some of the specific requests that Google has made of those candidate cities, including they want each candidate city or town to identify locations at which it could install these quote-unquote utility huts. Now, each hut would be 12 feet by 30 feet. That's 3.6 meters by 9.1 meters for the rest of the world. Now, the huts would be need to be accessible 24 hours a day. So they can't be locked behind some shed. They can't be in an area that's gated off. They have to be accessible from the street so that Google can get in there, do upgrades, do repairs at all hours of the day. And they'd have to be leasable for 20 years or more. Those are the ground rules. Google says if you can identify where we can put these in your cities, that will be a huge step towards making sure that you are one of the selected few. Now, they also want to be promised a list of addresses in each town or city, a description of building types, geospatial data on streets, boundaries, right-of-way, manholes, utility poles, zoning, pavement conditions across the town or city, and they want the status, which means whether or not they can use any fiber conduits that have already been laid. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because I know you're chomping at the bit. It's almost it's IT porn to hear about Google's plans for these cities. I mean, this is pretty advanced, right? I mean, this is basically Google sitting down and saying, give us the information so we can know exactly how much it's going to cost for us to deploy in your city.
Actually, it goes beyond that. They're basically asking for access to each city and county's ArcGIS database. They're going to want to be able to go and run simulations on flow controls, access. They're going to want to know where the cable conduits are so they can figure out how to get right of way, how to drag fiber to that so that you can get the Wi-Fi antennas up nice and high. Because remember, the number one cost for a cellular provider, which is not that much different from a Wi-Fi provider, is rooftop. And it's also the second biggest cost is actually the CO, where everything comes together. So what Google's trying to do is they're trying to get a significant advantage so that they know exactly how the game is going to be played before they decide to go into that city. It is something that a lot of cellular providers have wanted for a very, very long time and have not gotten. However, it is that we have not had anything even close to the demand for various cellular providers that we are now starting to see for Google Fiber, and I'll bet you we'll have the same thing for Google Wi-Fi.
Curtis, we've got some people in the chat room who are already piping up. We've got Gray580. We've got MattW783, who are essentially saying, wait a minute. Is this stuff that Tiebert's talking about true? Is Google going to get preferential treatment, data out of these cities and states and municipalities that their competitors wouldn't get? And if that's the case, doesn't this become unfair? I mean, why should cities surrender this data to Google? Is Google just blackmailing these cities with a service that they think that people might want?
Well, one person's blackmailing for a service that they think the citizens will want is another person's step towards providing a utility. And if you look at what they're doing with this, a lot of this sounds, as Tiebert said, very much like the kind of infrastructure and requirements that companies had for installing cellular. I mean, the building, the utility hut that they're talking about, isn't that far off the size of a small cell tower building. I think that what they're looking at doing, once again, is disrupting the environment by turning Wi-Fi into something that looks an awful lot more like a utility, like a telephone company. They've watched the ways that cellular service and cellular infrastructure developed and was deployed, and they're trying to get a march. What they're trying to do, it seems to me, is eat into the infrastructure head start that the cellular companies have. And if you want to look at an even longer play, just remember that word is out there that Amazon is getting ready to release a smartphone. We know that Google has a huge stake in the smartphone business. They're wrapping an awful lot into these communication infrastructure plays. That's going to get into the wireless networks, the cellular networks, the fiber networks. It's all coming together in the communications that allow people to reach their services. They want to, and then to use another really favorite word, disintermediate the cell companies and all of those ISPs out there. They want to be the golden cable or golden radio signal to the golden apps.
Perfect. Love it, Curtis. And actually, PC Guy 8088 in the chat room is right along with you with the magic phrase, common carrier. Tiebert, all the other telcos are trying to get away from this common carrier. This was the whole net neutrality debate. They don't want to be the common carrier. They are a service provider, but they add so much more. They don't want to just be the dumb cable. Here we have Google coming in and saying, no, we'll be the dumb cable. That's fine. We'll be that back end. We'll provide you all those services at a flat rate, and we won't do anything to monitor your traffic as long as you let us do our business in the back end. That's, in and of itself, that's crazy disruptive, right? I mean, if you've got one of the biggest players coming into the game and saying, we're going to do all that stuff you didn't want to do, shouldn't that force the telcos to maybe change their stance?
Well, you also got to remember who Google is founded by. These people don't like the status quo. They don't like the giant corporations. You know, the founders of Google have been very public about not liking monopolies, even though they're becoming a monopoly just because. But yeah, they let's put it this way. Google is slapping the telcos. It's gloves off time. They are big enough, they have deep enough pockets that they are going to really and truly change the industry because they want everybody to be connected all the time. Google Glass, handsets, everything. And they think they're going to change the world by doing that. And I think they're going to succeed.
Google slapping the telcos. I like that. Maybe that could be our show title. Now, let's move away from that. These are great stories, but we've got a full rundown full of them, and I don't want to use up any of our time. I want to introduce our guest. He's been on the show before, but not for over a year. Ladies and gentlemen, you know him. You love him. He's a man filled with experience and wisdom beyond his years. It's Mr. Evan Brown, the star of This Week in Law. You know, we need to have a sound effect with, like, fanfare. Thank you.
Hopefully somebody can just capture that, Padre. That would be good for the use. So thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here. You know, looking forward to talking about this stuff.
Now, Evan, I've been wanting to have you back on the show for the longest time. It's scheduling is just, it's always been tight. But we have so many legal stories that have cropped up over the last year, and actually even in the last week. We wanted to have a legal expert to come on to actually give us a lawyer's perspective, not just an IT or an executive perspective on what they might mean. Are you down with doing that?
Hey, that sounds good. And like we were saying, you know, we can make it up as we go along. But in all seriousness, though, there is a lot happening. You know, with the Supreme Court, FCC. You know, different. You know, so much exciting stuff happening with innovation. The law is always trying to catch up and keep up. So yeah, it's good to talk about that stuff from time to time.
Now, I know that just last week you were at a conference presenting about trolls, right? About legal trolls, patent trolls.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. It was at John Marshall Law School here in Chicago. And I actually, it was to a group of other lawyers. And lawyers have to keep up their continuing legal education credits. And there's an ethics component to that. And, you know, insert joke here, lawyers and ethics. But I was talking about some of the ethical issues with trolling and getting into the rules of professional conduct that lawyers have to abide by when they're, you know, deciding to file lawsuits that where they're representing somebody who may or may not have real strong intellectual property interests. So yeah, that was a lot of fun, and it gave me a good opportunity to sort of delve into the real nuances that at least try to regulate what lawyers do to keep them from going crazy and just being completely insane patent troll types.
Speaking of lawyers going crazy with completely insane patent types, we have our very own Chiebert. If you could switch to a shot of Chiebert here, who he loves patent trolls. He smiles with patent trolls. He slaps them with delight. Chiebert, you ready for a little patent trolly stuff?
Oh, sure.
Okay, let's go with one of our favorites. Rockstar. Rockstar, Rockstar, Rockstar. Now, if you followed our show, you know all about Rockstar. It was a consortium that was formed to sue people. No, really, that's it. I mean, you could start and end the description right there. Way back when, you may remember that in June of 2011, Apple, BlackBerry, Microsoft, Ericsson, and Sony purchased a set of patents from Nortel, from the defunct manufacturer. Now, the patents were bought for a total of $4.5 billion, and they covered technologies ranging from high-speed broadband, switched video technology, MPLS networking, optical network tapping, and streaming media. Well, they got together, put $4.5 billion into this pot, and they bought the patents and gave them to a new company called Rockstar, which is a non-practicing entity. Now, Evan, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what's your minute buzz on what a non-practicing entity is and what it does to society?
Well, a non-practicing entity is one of the nice names for patent trolls. You know, generally, if we think of patent law, we think of the exclusive rights that are granted to an inventor or somebody who has been assigned the rights in an invention. And, you know, we like to think of real industry and real innovation when we think of patents, when we're idealistic about it. You know, Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla or whomever, you know, the real innovator is, and whoever is going to do business the right way and go out and actually make things and take advantage of that government-granted monopoly. But a non-practicing entity, an NPE, is a nice name for a company who exists for that that exists for no other reason than to just assert those rights. And the big criticism is that of what patent trolling is all about, that it doesn't do anything to foster those initiatives of patent law. Another term you see thrown around a lot is a patent assertion entity. But again, these are just nice names for patent trolls. And so they have arguments that they're legitimate entities that are exercising rights that are clearly granted under patent law. And that's, I suppose, for the most part true. But the larger question is, are they good for innovation? Are they good for progress? Are they good for the economy? And those are much more controversial questions.
Chebert, Evan gave us the nice lawyer speak, the explanation that won't get him tossed out of a courtroom. You're an engineer, you're an IT admin, you're a sys guy. So how would you describe a non-practicing entity?
I'm going to get bleeped, so I can't.
We'll bleep you.
What I do have to say, though, is according to what I've been able to glean, Rockstar is possibly going to be running into a granite mountain soon in the term of the U.S. Attorney General's office. Some of those patents that they are trying to claim were developed with DARPA money. So that means it doesn't belong to any one entity except the United States government. And I would dearly love to see the Attorney General's office sharpen their knife and slice the patent trolls into little thin pieces of bacon.
So, Evan, that's normally how we deal with patent troll stories here on Twilight, but I like your avenue. Okay, now we know what Rockstar is. Now we know what they're doing. Let's talk about some news that I think will make Chebert jump with glee. And that is, a while back, they sued a bunch of manufacturers. They sued Google. They sued every competitor of Microsoft, Apple, Ericsson, et al. One of the things that they've been trying to do is to get all of their trials moved to East Texas, because East Texas, for some reason, has become very patent troll friendly. They get great judgments from East Texas. Well, a U.S. District Court judge has denied Rockstar's request to try their case against Google in Eastern Texas. Now, East Texas, again, is known as a troll friendly court, and Rockstar wanted to transfer to Texas on the grounds that its subsidiary Mobilestar owns some of the patents and has its principal place of business in the state. Now, let's do a little bit of background on Mobilestar, because this is where we get those companies birthing companies birthing companies. It's like a nesting doll of trolley goodness. So the consortium of those companies created Rockstar. Rockstar then, in turn, which, by the way, Rockstar is located in Canada, created Mobilestar, which is located in Texas. Now, everyone who works for Mobilestar works for Rockstar. The board of Mobilestar is comprised of the people from Rockstar. In fact, Mobilestar really doesn't do anything except have a small office in East Texas, and they were trying to use that as grounds to move the case. Now, Evan, let me throw this over to you, because I think we need the lawyer perspective here. How close was this to actually working? I mean, should this have worked? If Rockstar wasn't already a little notorious, could someone else have done this move, give birth to a smaller company in the place that I want the jurisdiction of the case to be, and petition to move my case?
Right. Well, it's funny you mentioned you forgot to mention a couple of steps. There was actually Rockstar Bidco LLP,
right.
It even took on a couple of different faces before Mobilestar was formed. And then Mobilestar was formed literally the day before the Halloween actions were filed in the Eastern District of Texas, which, you know, the court lovingly refers to them as the Halloween actions because, you know, they were filed against Asus. And who else was on that list? Asus, HTC, Pantech. So anyway.
Yeah. Google, HD, LG, Electronics, Huawei, Pantech, ZTE.
Right. So we've got to keep in perspective what was actually going on in this case here. This was a judge from the Northern District of California who was considering whether to allow the case to be transferred to the Eastern District of Texas, where there's the other cases going on, the Halloween action. So what was before the court was whether or not it was appropriate to exercise personal jurisdiction there in the Northern District of California. So that's what the court's the holding was about, and that's what the issue was about, whether or not it was appropriate to assert personal jurisdiction over the Mobilestar the entity there in California. And so, you know, who else could really get away? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that it depends on necessarily the identity of the parties here, but it was, you know, there certainly was plenty of opportunity for the court to talk about the very tenuous relationships with Texas, and on the contrary, the pretty strong connections with California, which is really where the interesting reading is, particularly with mobile stars and by extension, rock stars' communications with not only Google in some of the negotiations that it had had, the invitations to license, but even more intriguingly with Apple. Actually mentioned, the court's decision actually mentioned some of the backstory with, of course, Steve Jobs talking about thermonuclear war and relationship between Apple and Android. So that's where the really interesting reading is. It's all very intriguing, but let's keep it in perspective that this was a motion to dismiss. It certainly, as to where the lawsuit should be heard, had nothing at all to do with the actual merits of the dispute. We'll get a lot of opportunity for that as, right, as time goes on.
Yeah, actually, that's important. This doesn't end the case. The case is not done. They're going to continue. And they've got deep pockets, so they've got the money to keep pushing. It just means that they're not going to move the location of the case, right?
Right. It's not going to be in Texas. That's all that we know at this point, which, of course, is where Mobilestar. I keep worrying that I'm getting with these names because, you know, that's a trollish thing, you know, start up these entities that just sort of pop up overnight and the next day they're filing lawsuits from their rented office space in Tyler, Texas.
I think maybe they just need to stop calling all their new subsidiaries Star. Don't put Star in the name because I think we're onto that.
Well, it is interesting that it's Mobile Star as if it's, you know, could go anywhere.
it's Mobile Home Star. That's what it stands for. Curtis, let me ask you this. We've covered stories like this on TWiET before. Specifically, I'm thinking of Red Hat stepping up to bat to indemnify its customers, or Cisco stepping up to bat to indemnify its customers against Rockstar. That's a different approach, but it's one that I think merits mentioning in this discussion about the legal aspects. And that is, one of the things some of the bigger players in the business can do is step up to bat for their customers who don't have the money to defend themselves. And that's in their best interest, right? Because if a precedent gets set with a smaller case, it could affect the Ciscos, the Microsofts, the Googles of the world.
Well, it makes sense from a number of different directions. And you know, I will note that I am not an attorney, never played one on television, anything like that. But it seems to me that, as you said, the larger companies are first worried about what might happen if precedents are set. They are worried what might happen to their market if their customers are successfully sued and decide to stop using their products in order to avoid further litigation. I would say that the marketing, frankly, probably matters to them more than the legal aspect. These very large companies could, to be brutally honest, pay most likely legal settlements out of a week or two's profits. To me, the more interesting thing, though, is what the larger companies stepping in to indemnify their customers does to the strategy. Because what we've seen are a lot of these non-practicing entities cast a wide net, use the shotgun approach, knowing that many of the smaller companies will simply settle, even if it's for relatively small money, in order to avoid the cost of litigation. They depend on that. They're not prepared, either financially or legally, for every single organization that gets one of their letters to take it to court. I don't believe they could handle that. So they depend on the intimidation factor, and getting into battle with someone, an organization like a Cisco, that they simply cannot intimidate, works against them in some very profound ways.
Well, gentlemen, I would love to stay on this topic. You know that patent trolling is a big thorn in my side, that it's something that I really, really love speaking out against. But we paid Evan Brown a huge fee to be on This Week in Enterprise Tech, and I want to get our money out of it, so we're going to have to move on to the next topic. And that is SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, has heard arguments on Aereo. Now, again, there may be some people who have been living under a rock and said they don't understand what this Aereo case is about. Remember, Aereo is a company that was originally in the East Coast that rents antennas. They make these little dime-sized antennas hooked up to streaming devices so that you can stream your antenna over the internet. That's really all it was. Now, there was also a little bit of time shifting, a bit of place shifting involved, but essentially it was just a really high-tech antenna connected by the lines of the internet. Well, last week, the SCOTUS heard arguments in the case of Aereo versus a consortium of companies, including CBS, NBC, Comcast, ABC, and Fox. Now, central to the plaintiff's case is the 1992 Cable Television Consumer Protection and Competition Act, which required the consent, usually paid consent, of broadcasters for the right to retransmit. Remember that, retransmit content. Now, Aereo right now does not pay any fees of retransmission because they believe that they're only renting an antenna. They aren't retransmitting content. It's the customers who are choosing whether or not to play the content that they already own because it was captured on their antenna. Aereo is using the 2008 case of Cartoon Network LP versus CSC Holdings as their precedent. Now, this was a decision back in 2008 by the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which found against the consortium of copyright holders because the device at question, which is a DVR, a digital video recorder, wasn't actually retransmitting. This is what they believed. They believed three things. One, the automated copying of content at a user's request did not constitute direct infringement. Two, time shifting, which means replaying the original content to the original audience, did not constitute public performance of said copyright content. And three, copying streaming content for the purpose of buffering, not redistributing, but buffering, did not itself constitute unlawful copying. Evan, let me throw it over to you. Now that we've got that background, there's a lot of buzz that Aereo's use of the 2008 Cablevision case isn't going to pass muster this time. What's your analysis?
Mm-hmm. You said a lot of stuff there, Padre, as you customarily do, and there was a lot of legalese, and I'm trying to get through my head of precisely what you said. So the really important point is whether or not there is a public performance going on when one uses Aereo. And, you know, there's this whole question of time shifting that people talk about when they're talking about the Aereo case. Let's not let that be a red herring in the way that we think about what the Aereo case is all about. The question of time shifting goes all the way back to the question of whether or not it's a fair use of a copyrighted work. It goes all the way back to 1984 in the Supreme Court case that involved the Betamax tape that essentially validated home recording using the VCR. And of course, held that it's a fair use to make a copy of, you know, the Cosby Show or what have you in the mid-80s so that you can watch it later. So time shifting is not a legal issue that is in dispute here or in before the court, and we're not worried about that aspect of it. What we are concerned about and what we need to focus our eyes on when we're listening to how the Supreme Court is going to analyze this is the question of what constitutes a public performance. Because the way Aereo's technology is developed, as we know, is that it's one copy per user. The over-the-air signal comes into the little dime-sized antenna on top of the warehouse or wherever Aereo has these things. There's one copy that's created for that particular user, and then it's distributed. So from a certain conceptual standpoint, you can think of Aereo just like a DVR, except a DVR that has a very long cord, very long cable from where you are watching on your laptop or your mobile device to the warehouse there. So what the Supreme Court justices seem to be picking up on are a couple of things. First of all, I trust that not everybody who's watching or listening right now listened to the 1 hour oral arguments that went on last week. That's quite an experience. You can go to the Supreme Court website and hear oral arguments. It's very
interesting. You really should. Actually, it's fascinating to listen because the justices are always interrupting the lawyers.
It is.
It's not what you imagine it would be.
I think it's sort of a Supreme Court tradition to not let the lawyer get through their first thought, you know, before jumping in. And that's what Justice Sotomayor did in this. You know, she started out within the first couple of minutes of the argument asking the lawyer, Paul Clement, on behalf of the broadcasters, well, tell me why Aereo isn't a cable company. And, you know, he very artfully, he's a very skilled Supreme Court attorney, said, well, you know, that's really not the question before you right now, and gave some reasons why we shouldn't be thinking of it this way. Because the real issue is whether or not what the Supreme Court will be determining, unless it can just somehow decide that Aereo is a cable company and therefore send it back to the lower courts for more proceeding. What the Supreme Court will be evaluating and analyzing is this definition that comes from Section 101 of the Copyright Act of what it means means to publicly perform a work, because there's something a little bit weird, isn't there? I think we can all agree there's something weird about the fact that it's a copy that's made somewhere else. It looks a lot like what Cable is doing, but yet Aereo is saying it's not a public performance based on the 2008 Cablevision case, which is that Cartoon Network versus right. CSC that you're talking about there. We call it the Cablevision case. You know, based on that, the technology is a little bit different, and this is a little bit more of a Rube Goldberg type of solution. That's what Judge Chin has called it in the lower courts in proceedings in the Second Circuit. And, you know, and that's something that came out in Chief Justice Roberts questioning. Well, isn't this, you're just doing something here, Aereo, to circumvent copyright, and you get the sense that maybe the justices don't like that. The other big issue, and I don't want to go on too long here, but at least I'll just raise the issue and turn it back over to you, Padre, is the justices are keenly aware of the problem, the potential problem that exists here, that if they find against Aereo, that will kill cloud computing. Now, of course, a pronouncement like a decision against Aereo would kill cloud computing is, of course, overly broad, because there's way too much nuance in what we mean by those things. But suffice it to say that the justices are aware that they do run the risk of finding against Aereo in favor of the broadcasters that would somehow jeopardize the technologies that we've come to know and love, and which have experienced so much, enjoyed so much growth since 2008 with that Second Circuit Cablevision case.
Right. And folks, we can't cover the entire issue again. Remember, there was an entire episode of This Week in Law last Friday that was dedicated to covering this. If you want to find out more, go to that. What we want to do is now that we have the backing, now we understand what issues are being argued. And basically, Aereo is using the 2008 Cablevision case, and the broadcasters are saying it's a performance, it's a retransmission. Let's talk a little bit about the stuff that Evan was hinting about at the end of his statement there. And that is the effects that this could have on the enterprise, specifically cloud-based services. Chibert, let's assume that this goes all wrong. Let's assume that the justices come down and they say, no, this is not like the 2008 Cablevision case. You are not simply buffering. You are not simply time or place shifting, but you are actually rebroadcasting copyrighted content from the cloud, and we don't allow that. What does that do to cloud-based services?
Well, what it does to cloud-based services is it opens the door for the requirements for DRM where there is no DRM. We all love how complicated it has become to set up HDMI materials, HDMI systems. We've all loved the joy of activation keys. When you start saying you're moving original content around, that starts meaning the original owner of the content has to authorize the showing or the use of that content. So that possibly could mean, worst case, when you're using, say, Adobe Cloud Services, that each and every time you use Adobe Cloud Services, you have to uniquely identify yourself. So that means we're going to start having to carry around dongles just to use our cloud apps. Doesn't sound like a good thing for industry, if you ask me.
Yeah. Curtis, I want to bring you into the discussion here because, again, you can always offer us the more executive side of the enterprise. I know there are a lot of larger enterprises, Microsoft, Oracle, who offer solutions in the cloud, who are looking at this very closely. Because, as Evan alluded to, this is not just about one company offering something that's kind of like a Slingbox / DVR over the cloud. It's about delivering content. Now, right now, there's more of a laissez-faire approach to delivering services over the cloud. You rent your space, you rent your server, you rent your time, you rent your bandwidth, and everything else is up to you how you do it. If companies could start finding themselves open to some serious legal complications from allowing their customers to store copyrighted content and stream it from their servers, their services over the cloud to customers who shouldn't receive it, as Chibert mentioned, it's really going to kill the cloud-based delivery system, right?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I when I see this, I see a couple of different models. When most of us talk about enterprise computing and enterprise use of the cloud, I think it's a very different thing because, in general, cloud computing companies, not cloud computing companies, but corporations, enterprises, are going to put data that they have collected, that they own in some sense or another, onto the cloud, do something with it, then bring it back. I don't see any indication in anything that was argued that that kind of use case would be impacted at all. The place where it gets interesting are the companies that are providing a web application, a cloud application to someone else. And there, I suspect what we're going to start to see is a shift in the terms of use. The terms and service agreements are going to start changing, trying to shift responsibility for verifying ownership of intellectual property to the person, the entity, putting it onto the cloud. So if you want to put something on the cloud and let someone else get at it, you will have to essentially, through agreement, indemnify the cloud service provider against any claims because of that. All of this, of course, depends on just how broadly the Supreme Court would word any decision. And if they do decide against Aereo, I think it's likely that they'll do what they tend to do, and that is make their ruling on just as narrow a basis as they can get away with. So if I'm an executive and I'm storing stuff in the cloud using cloud services, cloud applications, I'm not real worried at this point. If I'm providing a cloud service, I'm getting a little concerned, but what I'm probably having my legal team do is look at the terms that I have to see if remedies against possible legal action can be contained and limited to my customers through the agreements they sign.
Evan, let me throw that over to you, because there's been a lot of speculation. There's the doomsayers, the ones who are saying, oh, well, if this decision stands, then of course Aereo is going to rule the world. Or if this decision goes against Aereo, that it's going to destroy the cloud. That's kind of what we've been talking about here. But you can give us the nuance here. What can the Supreme Court do? We already know that it's an 8-panel court because one of the Supreme Court justices has recused himself. But what can they do? They don't have to just rule one way or another, right? They could very, very closely limit the scope of their decision.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Supreme Court does things that is very surprising that we don't even anticipate. And this case got to the court in a bit of a strange situation. Usually there's a split among the circuits, you know, like the Federal Circuit in California, the Ninth Circuit will say something different than the Second Circuit, for example. And we do have a split. You know, there was the Second Circuit in the court, the federal court in New York, says that Aereo is okay. There's a district court judge in Utah, the lower court, saying Aereo is not okay and has entered a preliminary injunction that has yet to be heard by the Tenth Circuit. So it looks like there could be a split in the circuits, but not yet. So the reason I'm laboring that point a little bit is that the way that it got to the court was a bit odd, or at least not typical. So the court could do something perhaps procedurally. I don't even know precisely what that could be. But what the court could do, perhaps, and this is something, you know, that I think we would all need to think through a little bit more. But I did have lunch with an intellectual property professor last week who did suggest this, that the court could find that Aereo is a cable company. It meets the criteria, the definitions of a cable company. That may be what Justice Sotomayor is thinking, and say that it and what would happen then would be to remand it back to the lower case or to the lower court for further findings of fact and determinations and other briefing. You know, there's not been a real opportunity for this case to have been heard. This was all this made it all the way up to the Supreme Court very early in the proceedings. There hasn't been any real meaningful exchange of information, opportunities to really develop the factual record and the legal arguments in the lower courts for this to be determined. So it could be that there is this question that goes down to a lower court as to whether or not it would qualify as a cable company. And then we've got the whole set of issues as to whether it's going to be subject to the compulsory licensing scheme that's set out in the Copyright Act, which is a very Byzantine system, but does serve to manage the way that content is delivered and paid for through you know, the rebroadcast of signals. So a number of things could happen, and we could find ourselves pretty surprised on this. And there's probably at least a 50-50 chance that we won't get a real substantive ruling on this question of what it means to perform a copyrighted work publicly.
Well, gentlemen, I want to close out the Supreme Court of the United States just for a second, because we need to move on to the meat of the show. This is the legal issue that I think is going to impact the enterprise the most. Out of everything that we've talked about today, it's net neutrality. Of course, it's net neutrality. Now, again, unless you've been hiding under a rock, you've heard this go back and forth. The FCC just introduced a brand new plan for what they're calling net neutrality. The rest of the world is saying, are you out of your FCCing mind? All right, so what they'd like to do, according to Walker, is they'd like to protect net neutrality by giving ISPs the ability to create a fast lane. Now, in his description and in his defense, because he's been popping up all over the place trying to defend the plan, he's saying, look, we're staying true to the principles of net neutrality, of making it an unbiased network by increasing the amount of regulations that will decide whether or not the restrictions, the fast lanes that these companies are placing upon data is commercially reasonable. The rest of the world is looking at this, however, and saying, wait a minute, if you say net neutral, no, there's no regulations. You don't have any restrictions. You don't let the ISPs throttle data or give a fast lane because by its very nature, that means it's not neutral. Now, again, let's do a little bit of background. We know that this stems from the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which allowed the FCC to classify ISPs as either a telecom or an information service. A telecom is a common carrier. In other words, it's a pipe. It allows you to transfer data from one place to another. However, an information service is different because it actually does something with that data. The difference between the two is actually really important. A telecom can be regulated. You can make sure that a telecom acts as that dumb pipe, that common carrier. An information service, not so much. So when the FCC tried to institute their own net neutrality regulations, this was before Walker became the head of the FCC, the courts came back and said, you can't do that. You can't do that because way back when you decided that the ISPs were not telecoms, they were not common carriers, but instead they are information services and you have no regulatory authority. Okay, now let's fast forward. We know that one of the popular solutions was for them to reclassify ISPs. Go ahead and call them common carriers. Then they could just use the exact same net neutrality regulations. Instead, they've come back with whatever this is. I want to throw this over to you first, Curtis, because I want to take more of the enterprise perspective of this. What does the common CTO, CEO, CIO think about net neutrality?
Well, I think that the general impression is that net neutrality is a fine thing, especially where it protects that company's traffic. The interesting thing here is that a lot of executives, to the extent they know about what's going on the internet at all, feel that the video providers, the people who, like the Netflix of the world, are soaking up more bandwidth than is their fair share, with fair share being one of those terms that can be defined in any way you want. So from that perspective, the idea that no ISP can slow down traffic, but that you can pay to have your traffic be given preferential treatment, strikes a reasonable chord. If you're doing something that doesn't need the sort of time-sensitive, performance-critical networking that video does, well, then you can just go with the commodity and be happy as a clam, knowing that some of that video traffic that might be slowing down your banking app or sales app or what other other text-based application can get through just fine. If, on the other hand, you are a video-heavy enterprise, you're looking at this and you're wondering just what's going to happen to your bottom line, knowing deep in your heart that it's nothing very good. So I think that's really where the world comes down. If you're a big consumer or provider of video, you really hate this idea. If text is your game, you're feeling pretty good with what the FCC is doing these days.
Now, I do have to correct myself. Chat room was nice enough to point out the fact that I kept saying Walker. The FCC head is not Walker. Walker is Fast and the Furious. Wheeler is the Slow and Net Neutrality Curious. Let me go over to you, T-Bert. One of the things that Wheeler is trying to do is he's trying to say, look, there is, one, no turnaround in policy. This is an extension of the policy that we had before. Two, we are looking at behaviors that harm consumers or competitors, and we're not going to allow them. Three, there will be no blocking of lawful content. And four, there will be no discrimination among users. Now, that's what the FCC's official statement is, and that's their response to all this furor. How can there be such a disconnect between what they say their plan says and what people think it says?
You know, I'm not sure, but I found recently a good analogy. And I'm you know, it's in Los Angeles, they now have Lexus lanes. You pay to have access to these special carpool lanes. And really, that's what a lot of ISPs have done. You know, when you get business class cable modems, you get a Lexus lane. It gets higher priority anyway. So on one hand, a lot of the ISPs are already starting to do this, and they'd love to be able to have someone say, yeah, we, you know, defend us if someone goes and starts throwing a lawsuit at us. But I don't like the idea of people mandating things. I think I'm very much in favor of market pressure. And market says that, you know, if there's going to be a few extra cents tacked on to my Netflix subscription to pay for the access to the Lexus lane, so be it. I'd like to have my streaming video not pause every 10 minutes to rebuffer. But I also don't like the idea of the FCC mandating this, because I've seen how well the FCC has been able to mandate all kinds of rules. So I'm going to say I'm against regulatory net neutrality. I'd much rather see market pressures take over.
All right, gentlemen, now we're going to go to our legal expert. We spoke about this on Friday, Evan, so I kind of know what your viewpoint is. That's why I wanted both Chiebert and Curtis to get their views out. And now we can say that's a pretty fair representation of a lot of the anger and a lot of the fury that's going around the internet right now. How dare you call this net neutrality? How dare you give people a fast lane? How dare you demand that other companies pay more to get their content to you? You don't take the same furious route, right?
Well, for one thing, it's way too early to be furious. We don't even know what these rules are supposed to say. We just sort of have an idea of what they are. And even with that view that we have, I don't know precisely why we should be all up in arms and slinging a bunch of mud and throwing tomatoes and what have you quite yet, because we do have words. I mean, we have things like from the FCC. Most of it just seems to be kind of throwaway words at this point, you know, that they're committed to transparency and no blocking of lawful content and no unreasonable discrimination. Nobody knows what those things mean. And the big criticism is that, you know, particularly with this idea of a restriction against conduct that is not commercially reasonable, people get all upset because they don't know what that means. But that's perfectly, it could be perfectly good that nobody knows what that means, because it's open up enough for interpretation later as actual alleged discriminatory practices may arise, which may really be at the heart of what people are upset about here. There's a couple of ways of looking at it. There's the perspective of the consumer who wants to get their content via the fast lane. And then there's the perspective of the innovator as well. You know, it's sort of this mantra that's thrown out that if there is no network neutrality and there can be these special deals struck, then the next Twitter or next Facebook won't have the opportunity to emerge. And I see that. I just still think that at a policy level, it's way too early for us to tell exactly how we're going to prevent that from happening. And what I would not like to see is a situation, and I think that I'm tacking on to what Chiebert said there, is a reason to not like regulated network neutrality. And I'll throw out another analogy, if you'll indulge me, Padre. You know, I go to the grocery store, and I happen to like a really popular brand of coffee. And, you know, a lot of people like it. Let's just say, you know, it's like Folgers or Maxwell House or something like that. It's decent. It's not premium, but a lot of people like it. And I go there and, you know, I've been able to buy it for years, but I go there and one day the shelves are empty. Everybody has already bought all of this wildly popular coffee I like, but the shelves are full of stuff that I just don't like. That's really crappy. And there could be, you know, quite a bit of different kinds there. I go to talk to the manager and I say, you know, why can't I get my coffee? Well, you know, the whatever government regulation has been implemented so that I can't take bigger shipments of the kind of coffee you like. I have to take shipments of every other kind of coffee as well. And it's too bad that I sell out of this kind of coffee. I actually have to provide equal shelf space, equal space on the truck for everyone here. Now, of course, in my analogy, the Folgers is the content that everybody likes and is willing to pay a premium for, you know, high definition, extremely high quality, very produced content and high fidelity sound and stuff that I'd be showing on my 4K display and all that stuff. And the other kinds of coffee that are there are the other, you know, the startups. God love them. They didn't get a chance to become the next Facebook or Twitter, but the government made sure that they had shelf space so that I could have the opportunity to buy them. And then, of course, the regulation is the regulated network neutrality, saying it has to be an even playing field for everyone. We can't strike these deals. So, you know, I don't think that's the kind of world that we want to live in, but that's how I'm seeing it. And I would love nothing more than for somebody to help me see the world in a different perspective, to conclude that might be the sort of outcome that we would see if there was this regulated neutrality, which, you know, would be the government. I mean, it's just very weird this is just a principle with network neutrality. It's really weird. It's really paradoxical. And I think we gloss over this, that with network neutrality, that actually would require quite a bit of government regulation, saying we the government are going to get here and regulate it so that there is an open internet. You see the kind of the paradoxical nature of that at its essence?
I see what you're saying, but Jason, could you go ahead and bring up that graph really quick? So this is what we saw the very day that the FCC decided against them, that they couldn't maintain their old rules of net neutrality. On that very day, what we saw was Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, AT&T DSL, and Verizon DSL all dropping the speed of Netflix until Netflix started paying the extortion money and then Comcast went back up. On the other providers, you saw a constant stream, a constant rise of traffic. Now, I think this graph actually shows why that shelf space analogy, which, by the way, it's a great analogy, but I don't think it maintains. Here's the problem. When we're talking about bandwidth, we're not talking about shelf space. It is not a zero-sum game, but at the same point, we're barely stretching the walls of what some of these providers can do in their colos, the amount of data that they can transfer. So we're not saying, oh, because Netflix is taking up so much space on the internet shelf, none of these smaller players can get in there. That's not what we saw in that graph. What we saw was, well, they want to make more money. And so what we're going to do is we're going to throttle you unless you pay us more. Even though our networks aren't taxed, even though it's not having an adverse effect on any of the other traffic that's going across the networks, we know that we can hold you for ransom because there are no regulations that say that we can't. Chiebert, let me throw this over to you. What we just heard from Evan is actually what I hear a lot from people who are trying to argue on behalf of the telcos, saying, well, the telcos need to be able to manage their network, right? I mean, why are we getting upset? This is just something that they have to do. Does that hold true for you?
No, I don't know. I'm actually going to repeat what Bill_MI said to Evan Brown. I'm amazed it's never talked about. Telephone common carrier includes a liability protection for carrying illegal messages. I'm kind of wondering if that might be one of the read between the line things that might be happening. And I do agree with that. Common carrier has a whole can of worms associated with it. And maybe, just maybe, our friends at the FCC need to create something a little in between, some middle ground. Because I don't want the Comcast of the world to be able to purposely throttle someone just because they want to hold them ransom. But I also want to see market pressures prevail. So maybe, just maybe, we need a light hand at the FCC for something a little in between. It's not a common carrier, but it's not completely open.
Curtis, let me throw this over to you. Again, let's talk about that fast lane analogy. There are a lot of people who are saying, wait a minute. And Evan, I actually understand what he's saying, and it makes sense. But why should we penalize someone for wanting to pay to have your service faster? Right? I mean, can't we just rephrase the entire problem and saying, look, we're not going to affect traffic on the internet. We're just saying that if you want traffic to arrive more quickly, here's a way that you do it.
Well, to me, the fascinating thing is that the graph that you showed, and I have no reason to doubt that graph, would seem to go against what the FCC has said. You know, the FCC in its statement said no traffic would be throttled, no traffic would be slowed down, but you would have a chance to get preferential treatment. What we saw on your graph was that traffic was, in fact, demonstrably slowed down. So the idea that you can pay for preferential treatment, I'm really okay with. I really liked Chiebert's Lexus Lane analogy. So, you know, let's look at the video service providers. If Netflix wanted to have an advantage over, let's say, Amazon and its on Prime on-demand video service, then it could pay to get that. The same is true of Amazon. They could pay the ISPs. That's fine. But what I don't like, and what I don't think many people like, is the scenario that we actually had to deal with, which was a company's traffic being demonstrably slowed down. The question for the FCC and ultimately the courts is how to allow for one without encouraging the other. How do you allow for the preferential treatment without encouraging ISPs to see that someone's traffic suffers an unfortunate accident on the way to the customer?
It's the Godfather version of internet service.
There you go.
All right, Evan, one last question to you because we really have run out of time. Fascinating discussion, but I did want to get your thoughts on the 1984 Cable Communications Act. This was the act way back when that set the table for cable companies to grow. If you weren't alive back in 1984, you wouldn't remember it. But cable TV is actually a relatively recent phenomenon, and cable services is definitely a recent phenomenon. But back in 1984, the federal government got together with the local and state municipalities and said, wait a minute, we want to encourage cable companies to deploy because we believe they can provide a public service. We believe that they could offer something to your citizens that will be for the good. So what they did was they created this act, this 1984 Cable Communications Act, that struck a balance between federal, state, local, and cable company power. It allowed them to strengthen the position of cable operators, to have a process by which they could make sure to benefit off of the expenditure of money to deploy a cable infrastructure. Now, here's the rub. In exchange for establishing franchise standards and procedures, the Act specified that cable operators were expected to be receptive to their local communities' needs and interests. Specifically, it said that they needed to check to see if the behavior would be harmful to consumers or competition, and that would be the guiding principle of whether or not this cable operator would be allowed to continue to operate. It seems to me that the 1984 Cable Communications Act does exactly what the FCC wanted to do with net neutrality, which is as long as you continue to serve the customer, we'll let you do what you want to do. The minute you do something detrimental, we don't have to pass another act. We've already got recourse through the 1984 Act.
I mean, that's a pretty nuanced point. And you know, to be honest, I don't know the answer to how the FCC would do that, you know, what kind of mechanisms it would go through. I guess the comment that I would have on it is that there's a lot of really sort of vague, throwaway, broad language in that, just like there is in the discussion about what it is that the FCC is going to do next, you know, serving the interests of the community. You know, these are not really articulable standards, but you've got to look at what actually happens in place. But, you know, in any event, Padre, I think that's you know, looking for a simple and elegant solution to a complex problem is what we need to be doing more thinking about here. And that's why I think that open language like what we see here could be a good thing. And I would encourage people to, you know, not be so quick to take a cynical perspective on open and broad language like commercial reasonableness. We deal with those kinds of terms all the time in commerce and all kinds of commercial agreements and contracts outside of telecom, outside of intellectual property, just in, you know, contracts for the sale of goods. You know, so there's plenty of space, and we need to be measured in the way that we do these things incrementally here. And the biggest mistake could be that if Chairman Wheeler tries to push this through before the end of the year and ends up making a mistake just because of the rush of time with it. But I like what you're saying, Padre, about an elegant solution.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that you've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 8 out of 9 Supreme Court justices. I'd like to thank my panel for coming on, for giving us such an entertaining discussion on this all-legal episode of TWiET. I want to start with my good friend Brian. Brian, where should the TWiET riot find you?
I have articles that are being posted to InfoWorld magazine And if all goes well, there's going to be a new one on our friends at IOSafe. I'm going to try and get that done. And there's also some nice ones coming out from about Lantronics terminal servers.
Lantronics, we'll keep our eyes open. And Curtis, I know you've always got good things coming on at Enterprise Efficiency. Where can the Twilight Riot find you?
Well, as you say, Enterprise Efficiency keeps bumping along, and some interesting news. Hope people will stay tuned, because it looks like the radio efforts may well be spreading to Information Week, dark reading, and network computing. So you may be able to hear my voice other places. We'll keep you posted and hope that you'll be able to listen in when we do get some of the new things going.
Thank you, you two. Of course, I want to thank my guest, Mr. Evan Brown. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on. Every time you come on, it is just it's magical, the amount of discussion that takes place. We can't do this every week, but, you know, it is nice every once in a while to remember there's a lot of crossover between the shows at This Week in Tech. I mean, law tech. And it's nice that you've made that trip over to the light side. But if you want to tell the folks where they can find you, what do you want to say to the Twilight Riot?
Thanks, Padre, so much. It's great to be here. Yeah, every Friday, Denise Howell and I co-host This Week in Law. That's at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, so in whatever time zone you may find yourself in, do the arithmetic there. So we look at issues a lot like what we've talked about today, law, policy, technology, and the way that all of those things interact. So we have a great time every Friday. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Internet Cases. I also write a blog over at internetcases.com that I update once in a while. And check out my law firm's blog, infolawgroup.com. I've got some very smart colleagues who write about information security, privacy, intellectual property, marketing, everything interesting going on, you know, in these spaces that we're talking about here. So, Padre, it's been great. G-Bert, Curtis, great talking with you too. I've had a wonderful time, and I can't wait until the next time to do it again.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much. You made this episode magical. But you know who else made it magical? All of you. The people who listen, who watch, who download our show each and every week, who come here live to watch us. And so we want to do something for you. We want to give you a way to get This Week in Enterprise Tech on your device of choice automatically. Jump on over to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat, that's T-W-I-E-T, and you'll find a drop-down menu with all the RSS feeds so you can have every episode downloaded to your iPhone, to your iPad, your laptop, your desktop, your Android tablet or phone. Basically, any way you want to consume our content, we're going to find a way for you to do it, because we love you. Also, did you know that we do this show live? It's like every Monday here on live.twit.tv, 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. If you come in early, you can actually watch us set up the show and stay late to see what we do when we have to clean up. You get to see all the stuff that goes on that maybe doesn't make the finished cut. And as long as you are in the live show, why not join us in the live chat room as well? You see that I pull questions from the people in chat. It's filled with some of the brightest engineers, some of the funniest people, and yes, some of the funniest trolls. Go figure. Also, I want to thank everyone here at the Brick House who made this show possible, to Lisa, to Leo, to Carson, my super producer, and of course, my TD. Folks, he's a man of mystery. He's a man of intelligence. He's a man whose talents know no bounds. In fact,
no bounds.
I understand that he actually is an android.
I'm not sure if I'm an android. Maybe more of an Oompa Loompa, but I do have an Android show. It's called All About Android. And you can watch it every Tuesday night, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv.
Live.twit.tv. That's the magic link. And folks, until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballister reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.